Oh, that's an action. Okay. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Arcana Archives, a deep dive into Nerdrum. Wow. Nerdrum. Okay. I'm just going to redo that.
You're fully prepared.
And welcome back to Arcana Archives, another deep dive into nerdom. Today we have on very special guest, Clarissa Smedley. She's back again. She did Lord of the Rings before, and today she's going to tell us about The Office. And I'm very excited.
Back again.
Guess. Yeah, I just, my interests don't really lie outside of pop culture. What can I say?
A wealth of knowledge on all these different pop culture things. Like, I could be like, hey, do you know the movie, like, Guardians of the Galaxy? And you'll be like, ah, yes, that has, and then you name all the listed actors.
It's only for really specific things, though. Like, there's aspects of pop culture I know nothing about. So, it's only really my interest, and then I know everything about it for some reason.
And that's what makes you the perfect guest for Arcana Archives, because you get a nerd out about something that you're interested in.
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay, so let's go around and say our fun facts for the day. I guess sure. I'll go first. My fun fact is brought to you by Clarissa's idea last night. The cover art.
I was just curious.
The cover art for our podcast has a filing cabinet. And coming out of the filing cabinet is a vinyl, a muffin, a watermelon, and there's a cat on it and some running shoes. And the reason why is because when I was designing it, I asked Rogan for three things that he was passionate about. And I came up with three things that I was passionate about. And Rogan's were running, collecting vinyls, and baking. And mine were my cat Thunder. He's on top of the cabinet. Cooking, so the chef's hat, and the watermelon kind of represents like summer and stuff, and they're all coming out of the little archive folder, and the rainbow and pot of gold is just because I thought it looked cool. So yeah, that's my fun fact.
Oh, that's great, because looking at your logo, I was like, I know that cat's Thunder, but who else knows?
Nobody knows.
All right, well, I'm Rogan, and my fun fact for this week is I bought Lego The Lord of the Rings a couple weeks ago, and
going
through a nostalgia trip.
That's so funny. You know what? My dad came to visit me recently to see my house, and he found I have a backpack full of my old Lord of the Rings action figures that he brought back to me, so that was pretty cool. That's not my fun fact. But, like, your fact definitely reminded me of that.
Yeah, like, all the Lego games are on Steam.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's fantastic.
Well, as I'm sure all of you know by now, I'm Clarissa. And my fun fact is every year, except for last year, sadly, I volunteer with the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. I volunteer in the Media Guest Services department of it. And what that means is all the guests and celebrities that come to the expo that year, we get personally assigned to one. And then we pretty much just help them, like, maintain their schedule, get them food and go on breaks and stuff, and, like, help them sell their autographs and photos and stuff like that. So I've been doing it for, I think, 11 years now. And whoa. I've got to meet some pretty cool people doing it. So.
And yeah. This year you volunteered with Dante Basco.
Basco. I got to work with him this year, and he was super nice, and it was just great too, because everyone was just so happy to have the expo back. You know, it's kind of like nerd Christmas.
I feel it sorry is like for nerd Christmas. I feel sorry for the people who have to volunteer with William Shatner.
he So I have a lot of feelings about, but the thing is though, is like, he wasn't just kind of grumpy and mean to volunteers. He's like that with everyone. Yeah. So, but yeah, no, I have many stories. Maybe we could do an episode and I could talk all about that. Who knows? But I have a lot of cool behind the scenes. I've got to meet and interact with almost everyone who's ever come in the last like 10 years. Whether it's just like passing them in the hallway, saying hi, stuff like that. Like,
do you see Brendan Fraser this year?
No, because he canceled.
Oh no.
Yeah. Super unfortunate. Hopefully he can come back in the future because, yeah, he's a Canadian gem.
Mm-hmm. I don't know who that is.
Okay, so Chelsea, you don't know who anyone is. he's like a really big, popular star, Canadian star from the 90s. He was in like George of the Jungle and The Mummy.
Oh, okay.
He was a fucking stud. Still is. But yeah, that's not what I'm here to talk about now, is it? I can talk about The X forever. Don't get me wrong.
We'll do a full episode on it one day.
Just a full episode on Brendan Fraser.
Oh my god. Yo, that man has been through it. But yeah, anyways, I'm here to kind of talk about one of a show that is near and dear to my heart is The Office. And to me, it's one of those like comfort shows where if I've had a rough day, I just put it on the background, like if I'm cleaning my house or if I'm cooking or doing whatever, it's like my go-to.
So how many times would you say you've seen The Office then?
Oh, at least once a year for the last like 10 years.
That's like me with Clan Ad.
Yeah.
I just watched through for the seventh time.
Oh, geez.
And have a good 3-hour cry every time.
Oh yeah, there's some episodes that that get to you in the office.
I skip Scott's tots every single time.
That makes me cry for totally completely unrelated reasons. It's not out of sadness, it's out of just sheer cringe.
The cringe. Ooh. Is so cringe. Rogan, have you ever seen The Office?
No.
Oh, all right. That's okay.
I think that'll be good because maybe some of our audience hasn't seen it either, and we can just talk about like this cult classic, and Rogan can ask questions when we start talking about things that nobody knows about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm mainly going to talk about like how the show even came to be, and the fact that it's just to this day, 16 years later, is so like wildly, intensely popular.
That show is 16 years old.
It started in 2004.
Dang.
Yeah.
Things from 2004, 16 years old. Oh. Oh, no.
I know. I'm like, yeah, like 10 years ago in the 90s, I'm like, 1,000-yard stare, realizing that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the Office actually started in the UK first. So in Ricky 2001. Gervais. Pardon?
Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, see, you know something. Yeah, so Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant wrote and came up with this show. They, I guess in England, they have a lot of kind of dry documentary type style shows to begin with. So they kind of wanted to make a parody of those shows. So they picked something completely mundane to do this fake documentary about and landed on the paper company.
That explains so much.
Yeah.
It's like, where does this idea come from? Like, who would watch something like that kind of thing?
And that's exactly, that was actually a huge focal point and struggle for bringing it to the United States, because TV like that in that kind of style and format didn't really exist here. So it was a big controversy to bring it to America.
Wow, really?
So in 2004, a NBC employee named Kevin Riley saw The Office and just became obsessed with it. He was like, this is humor unlike we've ever seen before. Nothing like this exists in the United States. Mm-hmm. Like, he became obsessed. And he actually met with Ricky Gervais and Steven to talk to them about, like, hey, do you guys think that the show would do well in America? Because in the past, you know, whenever America tried to kind of like recreate foreign shows, they usually didn't do very well. It didn't translate properly. And they were a little skeptical at first, but they were evidently like, yeah, okay, sure. Like, you can give it a go. See what happens. So Kevin brought the idea back to the United States and went to like dozens of different television networks, like HBO and stuff like that. And all of them said no. They turned him down. They were like, this is what are you giving me this crap for?
I bet they feel real stupid now.
I'm sure, because yeah, every television network at the time like turned them down. They're like, what is this about? Why? Like, it didn't make sense to them. They didn't understand like how this could be a successful show. And then he brought it to NBC, and NBC was just like, a little sus, but sure, give it a go. So once the show got accepted by NBC, he had to build his team. And the first person he went to was the showrunner, Greg Daniels. And Greg Daniels had a lot of background working on comedies. He did, he wrote episodes for The Simpsons. He worked on Saturday Night Live. And he actually was the creator of King of the Hill.
Whoa, I did not know that.
Yeah, so he created King of the Hill, and the only kind of hesitation they had was, well, King of the Hill is an animated show, like how will he do coming to like a live film show? And he was just like, oh, don't worry about it, we'll figure it out. A lot of getting the show started was just like, oh, we'll figure it out, it'll be fine,
we'll figure it out. And they figured it out. They did.
Yeah, no kidding, eh? So Greg was like, hey, I have this masterpiece made out of glass and eggshells. I have to be so careful not to break it and do it justice. Mm-hmm. So it was really important to him to get the proper crew and cast. So he went on, and his whole thinking of it was, is he wanted writers of the show to also be actors in the show, which is something that was just like not very common.
I know that Ryan was acting and writing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Ryan Howard was played by BJ Novak, and he wrote 12 episodes for the show. And wow. Between writing, like they did producing and a little bit of directing, like they all kind of did their own thing. And if one person wrote a script, there was 15 other people who had written portions of it too, right? Like it was a very, the reason why The Office works so well and came out the way it did is it was very highly collaborative.
Oh, that, I love that.
Very like Saturday Night Live concept.
Yeah, it was, well, yeah. And the Saturday Night Live was actually like an adjacent NBC show. So they did take some of the writings and how that show worked and applied it for sure. Another actor who is also a writer on the show was Toby Flenderson.
Makes me feel a lot better about his character.
Yeah. So Toby was played by Paul Leverstein. He wrote about 16 episodes, and he also did the web series that NBC released called The Accountants, starring Oscar, Angela, and Kevin. I think there was about 6 episodes of that.
I've never seen that and didn't know that existed, so that's something I'll have to watch.
it was one of the very first like online content that was created like that. Like back then, like streaming wasn't a thing. Like you couldn't really find TV online, and they were one of like kind of the first ones to do it, and it was highly successful. It won an Emmy when the show itself
How have I never heard of this?
Yeah, I don't know, but it's pretty cool. And then another writer actress was Kelly Kapoor, who is played by Mindy Kaling. And she wrote 22 episodes of the show.
Whoa, man, I think that having the actors also be writers gives them the opportunity to make the actors do things that give you that like cringe that you get when watching some moments in The Office.
Oh, like, 100%.
I think that, like, I don't know, I've written a few plays myself, and I'm always scared to like really have those cringe moments in there, because I'm like, oh, what if the actors aren't happy with it? So having that's the actors what, involved.
Yeah, and that's what made the show so great, is everybody was very much on the same page, and everyone very much like understood kind of the vibe of the show, right? Because yeah, it was like they would often leave like long seconds of just dead air where like nothing was happening, nobody was speaking. It was just really kind of like awkward silence. Like they really let you sit in those moments, and that's like unheard of at the time.
And that kind of goes back to the concept of Maw that Rogan was telling us about a few episodes ago.
Like they were the, man, in North America, everybody's so afraid of silence.
Except
in the media.
I guess The Office was probably one of the first shows to really like be like, ah, yes, this is a great concept. Let's use the heck out of it.
Yeah, except I feel like their use of Maw wasn't for like tranquility or peace. It was to make you feel uncomfortable.
Yes. Yeah.
It really played off people's uncomfort with silence and awkward spaces. And
I'm sure there's a Japanese word for that too.
Oh, probably. Ooh. But that's like the foundation of the show, really. So next up, after he kind of got some of those people involved, he contacted casting director Allison Jones, who is another, I feel like, major factor into the show's success, because she had a really good insight into like the kind of people that they were looking to cast in the show. Like they didn't, it was supposed to be a documentary about like mundane everyday people, so they didn't want really really famous movie stars or well-known people.
And
Greg approached her because of her past record. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of a show called Freaks and Geeks, but it's a little show. Yeah, it's similar to The Office, but like also vastly different at the same time. But it starred people like James Franco and I should have written notes about this, but my God, who plays Marshall on How I Met Your Mother? What is his name? Yeah, so it was kind of like the first intro to that a lot of famous people had that weren't famous yet. And I would argue that's kind of what happened to The Office. Like she kind of introed these lesser known actors and actresses who then became like kind of famous through the show.
Yeah, like they're recognizable around the world that way, people who have seen The Office because of The Office.
Yeah, exactly. So the very first person who was officially cast on the show was Dwight Schrute, who is played by Rainn Wilson.
Really? He was the first person cast?
Yeah, and he actually applied for the role of Michael, but because of just the way Rainn is in real life, they were like, you know what? You would make a perfect Dwight.
I love that he applied for Michael because throughout the show, he tries to get Michael's job.
Yes, he's method acting.
Yeah.
And then Steve Carell was actually the last person cast in the whole show.
Steve Carell plays...
He played Michael.
Michael.
Yeah. Yeah, Michael Scott. So, like, the lead star of the show was the last person cast. A cute story, too, is when John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer both found out that they had got the roles that they applied for. The first thing that they asked was, oh, did the other person, like, did they also get their role? Because they both thought when they did, like, script reading together, when they were applying, that they were just, like, the perfect cast. And if they cast anyone else, the show wouldn't do as well. So,
Jim and Pam wanted Jim and Pam to be Jim and Pam.
Exactly. Yeah. They were like, no one else can do it. Blasphemous if it is. And then, and it ended out that they both got the role.
And I guess the directors agreed because, they both got the role.
Yeah. And it's so funny that John got hired in the first place because, like, he was kind of waiting outside to be called in. And he was like kind of chatting with everyone else, and he had seen the England or the UK office before, and he was just like, man, you know, I really hope they don't screw this up. And then Greg Daniels was like, oh, I'm sure we won't, because John didn't know like who he was speaking to at the time. And then so going in, John was just like, oh God, they're not going to hire me. I ruined everything. I should just leave now.
Oh no.
And then they hired him.
Yeah, exactly.
That's such a cute story.
And then another...
Steve Carell is, like, pretty infamous for those, like, really awkward roles. Like, just playing an awkward dude.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, like, when he first got onto The Office, I think that he was on The Daily Show. He did a couple SNLs. Like, he wasn't really well-known quite yet. But one of the... audition process is Allison Jones had a casting assistant named Phyllis Smith. And as she was reading with the actors and actresses, their lines going back and forth, Greg Daniels was like, I love her demeanor and the way that she's delivering her lines. Like, I want to make her a part of the show. So he made her Phyllis Lapin Vance.
Oh my gosh.
She had no experience acting before. She had worked as a casting assistant for years alongside Allison Jones. And Greg just like decided like, yes, you, I want you to be in my show. And she was just like, oh, okay.
I cannot imagine the show without her. Like, she's the perfect Phyllis.
Literally. Another kind of funny story is how Creed Bratton is like 100% just playing himself in real life. Like, Creed Bratton is not a fictional character. Creed Bratton is like just a like real man.
Really?
Well, he's definitely not nearly as creepy in real life as he portrays himself in the show. Like, he definitely hams it up, but he just plays himself in the show. Like, he really is in a band called Grassroots. He really did tour and play with like The Doors and stuff like that back in the day. Like, everything that is Creed Bratton in this show is like actually Creed Bratton in real life.
Oh my gosh. Including like the allusions that he's had drug problems in the past.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
He's super open about like doing blow with Jim Morrison and kind of his like party rock star days.
Man, I didn't know that Creed Bratton was based off of something that happened in real life. And also, I always thought that Creed Bratton was kind of like making stuff up and like definitely didn't actually do those things. So next time I rewatch, I'll have to go in with a mindset that Creed Bratton did in fact do everything that he's saying that he did.
Well, outside of like the murder and the crime and stuff like that, like those weren't like, that was definitely just like a character thing. But
yeah.
Another really, really important member of the cast actually ended up being the cameraman of the documentary. So, like, famously, Jim looking to camera, and a lot of the actors talked about how they would portray their characters differently if they knew that the camera was on them or not.
Huh.
So, like, Michael was one of the... He was in the mindset of, like, this film crew is coming to my office and maybe Jennifer Aniston will see it one day and this will be my launch point. Like, I'll be a famous movie star. So that's why Michael is so like eccentric and kind of crazy. Like, he's actively performing for the cameras and he's like very aware that they're there and he's like trying to put on a performance, right?
Oh, like, because it's like a parody of a documentary. So when the documentary cameras are filming, Mike, that explains so much.
Yeah, and they really felt like the camera person was somebody like somebody who could they could act with, or they could bounce things off of, or like they were like another actor in the room with them. And I thought that was a really interesting thing because most TV shows, like, you don't look at the camera, like the camera doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, and the main cameraman was Randall Einhorn, and they thought that he would be a good fit for filming The Office, even though he had never actually filmed any sort of scripted TV before. He shot like sport documentaries, and he actually was like one of the main camera people for Survivor.
Whoa. So he'd filmed like actual live, not, I mean, Survivor isn't a documentary, but...
Documentary style for sure, like not scripted TV. And that's why they thought that he would be so good in this role because of his like filming technique, and he knew like how to film exactly like what they were looking for, and in that sort of style that made the show so special.
Yeah. Oh, and he has a moment with Pam, like, on camera, too, at some point, doesn't he?
That's the boom operator that they cast. Oh, okay. Yeah, in season 9, they kind of broke the fourth wall and had the crew, like, step in and interact, which is something that they didn't do before and was kind of, like, a would they, won't they? Like, it was really, really heavily debated, but then, yeah, that happened, so... Well, and you have to think, too, like, in the early 2000s, if you think of, like, really, really popular TV shows at the time, like, that was, like, the era of Friends and My Name is Earl and kind of sitcoms that had a certain algorithm, and the way that they worked where it was just, like, joke, laugh track, joke, rebuttal, laugh track, etc. There was no laugh track in The Office. The way that they filmed, even... they didn't want to have perfect camera shots or perfect angles of scenes. Like a lot of The Office is the camera rotating to try and catch people's reactions and try and catch things in the moment, because they didn't want it to seem like it was set up or as if the camera knew that something was about to happen. So a lot of the times the kind of direction they would give, they wouldn't give the camera people any direction. They wouldn't tell them everyone got like a general script. But they wouldn't tell them, like, okay, I want you to film Pam right now, or I want you to film Dwight. They would just say action, and then it was up to the cameraman to, like, find those points or find those reactions. And
Get a lot of good shots like that. Like, sometimes Dwight and Jim will be doing something, and then they just zoom in on Pam.
Yeah. and it gave the show, like, a really unique type of filming. And then another thing about that is with those shows too, like, you think of the cast of the Friends, they're all like hot.
Yeah.
Like, to be on network television was traditionally like attractive people, right? And that was another reason why networks were so hesitant to take on The Office, because they were like, who are these kind of
no name, mundane looking everybody's?
Exactly. It was very like
Brooklyn Nine-Nine with Hitchcock and Scully.
Yeah. But if you look at the rest of the cast, like, they're hot.
Yeah.
Well, okay, except for Charles, but but yeah.
He's not like ugly though.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm sorry, I was really distracted by your cats playing in the background for a second there.
Oh yeah. They go buck wild, I tell you.
Yeah, you never really hear about like cameramen having to improvise like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you hear of all these moments that are like, oh, this is an improvised line that made the movie and stuff, and it's all sort of like from the actors or like directors throwing stuff in like last minute. But it's interesting to think of that as like the cameramen very much had to think in the moment and be like on a swivel and capture all that was going on there, like, with no direction at all.
And they really gave The Office like a unique take that made The Office. Like, I don't think it would have been the same if they had been like, okay, film Pam now. Okay.
Yeah. 100%. Like, there was no marks, and like a lot of TV sets, like, they film on, I'll talk about it a little later, but they film on a studio stage, which is like where the walls move, so you can get cameras in places to get the perfect shot of things. But Greg Daniels was like, absolutely not. We will not do that. So that's why some of the film cameras are at such weird and awkward and kind of like poor angles, is because they really wanted that authenticity of like just a real person with a camera going around trying to film these people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
That's very Brooklyn Nine-Nine too, where they actually film in like an office building.
Yeah. Well, the pilot was filmed in a real office building. The entire season 1 was filmed in like a real, just front of the mill office building in Culver City called Century Studios. But by the time they reached season 2, they actually did move to like a traditional soundstage in Chandler Valley Center Studios. But they still didn't, like, it wasn't very customizable, you know.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that the first season was filmed in a real office.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so funny to think about the show now versus when it was coming out, because, like, every single day that they worked on The Office. Like, they pretty much filmed the pilot and then was like, hey, see you never, because the show is never going to get picked up by the network. Like, there was, like, the show, the people who were in the show and the cast and the crew really believed it was something special, but because they didn't get a lot of, like, positive or supporting feedback from the networks, they were just like, well, this is it.
They pilot episode and wrap party in the same day.
Literally, that was very much the mindset. And then the studio was like, okay, we'll give you 6 episodes for season 1, which is like tiny baby. Like, most show seasons are like 20 to 24 episodes, right?
Yeah.
So they did their 6 episodes, and every day they were like, okay, well, who knows if they'll see you next week. Bye-bye. There was only like 4 main cast members, and everyone else, like, if you think of like Stanley, the accountants, and everyone else, like, they were week to week contracts. And then in season 2, NBC was like, okay, well, we'll do a season 2 for you, but they cut their budget, which was very small to begin with already, but everyone had such faith and determination to make and be the show that everyone just agreed. Like, everyone took budget cuts. They were like, we just want to create this show. It's special. It's different. They really saw the potential in it. So everyone
That's
just
so
like
wholesome.
Yeah, instead of just like walking away from it, like, oh, a budget cut, and like, no, they all came together. We're like, yep, we're gonna make this work. We have something here. We know it. And so everyone just cared about like making a good show.
They were like, we'll get our money later when this show takes off, which I know it will.
And then it wasn't until the end of season 2, the episode called Booze Cruise, where the series or the week by week people were actually made series regulars. And that was kind of like the first indication of like, oh, we might be onto something here.
We might be onto something.
Yeah.
I think I've seen clips from Booze Cruise.
Yeah. Michael decides, like, the company is like, hey, we're not going to give you money to just like randomly throw parties anymore. So he was like, oh, okay. And he figured out a loophole that if he made it like a business, like motivational meeting or whatever they're called, like a team building exercise or whatever, that he could still get the company to pay for it. Yeah. And then they had like famous actors on the show, like before they were even like really super famous. Like, that was Amy Adams played Jim's temporary girlfriend, and she came on to be like a huge name.
I don't know who that is. Well, I know who Jim's temporary girlfriend is and what she looks like and stuff, but I like didn't know she was in other things as well.
Yeah. So after they did season 2, Steve Carell got cast and starred in the role the 40-year-old virgin, which then came on to be like a comedic success. Like, the movie was extremely popular, and then because of that, the show kind of gained popularity off of Steve's back. And everyone is so like open about the success of the show being accredited to Steve Carell.
Huh. He's just such like, he plays such an awkward character that I like would never imagine that the show would be successful because of him.
Yeah. Well, a lot of like, he was kind of like the main focus. He was like the backbone kind of the show. Like, he really drove a lot of the scenes and storylines, and I guess Steve himself just on the set was like obviously completely different from Michael. And the way another reason the show works so well is even with his climbing fame, he never called it like the Steve Carell show. Like, he was so willing and there for everybody to get their screen time and for other people to land the amazing jokes and everyone kind of share the focus, which is really nice.
And that's so important. Like, I think that's another thing that really made the show is everybody has had their time to shine.
Exactly. Another contributing factor to the huge growing popularity in the show was so in the episode The Christmas Party, which was I think episode 11 of season 2, they featured the iPod video that just came out. Michael buys it for their Secret Santa exchange, even though it was only a $20 limit. A week after that episode aired, like, they didn't have a contract with Apple. Like, there was no discussion or agreement beforehand. That it was just like a part of the story. They put that Apple iPod video in, and a week later, that episode became downloadable on the iTunes store. And then, The Office eventually went on to be the most downloaded show in the Apple store.
And they didn't have an agreement beforehand. Apple was just like, you know what? Seems like a good idea.
Yeah. And because of that, like, their online ratings went higher than, like, their network ratings, because it's still relevant to this day. Just, like, The Office really appeals to, like, a younger generation for whatever reason. So, like, you know, the audience that was watching the show on a regular schedule on TV, it didn't appeal to them as much as the people who streamed it or watched it on iTunes, which was typically a younger audience.
I'd be interested to see some of the, like, marketing personas behind who watches The Office and what their senses of humor are and why there's such, like, a big online audience.
Well, that's the big question to today, even, like, how 16 years later was The Office the number one most streamed show on Netflix with 57 billion minutes streamed in 2020.
Holy crap.
And that's the thing, like, 16 years later, the show is still, like, one of the most watched shows in television history.
And I've seen it 3 times. You've seen it 10 times.
Oh, I'm like, I'm at least 10 billion of those 57 billion. At least, like,
I think, I mean, The Office has really good rewatchability because it feels like you're just hanging out with the people. Probably, yeah, because of the camera angles you were talking about earlier. But yeah, I'd love to see, like, a deep study into that.
For sure. So, and then in, so the show was on the rise. It was gaining popularity like crazy. And then in 2007, during season 4, there was a national writer strike. So a lot of writers had to belong to something called the Writers Guild of America. And they essentially went on strike to be like, hey, we deserve to be paid better by large networks and compensated for the great work that they did, because there's a lot of work that goes into writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was really sweet to see, because a lot of the cast and actors from The Office, like, really, really supported their writers and, like, would picket with them and protest with them. And but the sad thing is the writer strike went from November 5th, 2007 to February 12th, 2008. And a lot of shows did, like, not survive.
Oh, no. I'm glad The Office survived.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Same. but it was kind of funny because, like, at the very beginning of the writer's strike, actress Angela Kinsey, who plays Angela Martin, are everyone's favorite bitchy blonde. She was pregnant at the beginning of the writer's strike, and she was, like, just barely beginning to show. And then by the end of the writer's strike, she was just, like, a huge, like, showing immensely. And then so it was really awkward and hard for them to, like, work around and film that. but because of that, like, season 4 is the shortest season of The Office, other than season 1, coming in at only 18 episodes.
Oh, because Angela was really pregnant.
No, but mostly, but because of the writer's strike, like, they didn't have enough time to write and film and do everything they needed to. So they just had to cut it to 14 episodes.
I guess that makes sense. You know, you got your writers on strike. What are you gonna do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they could have kept filming and could have kept up with production, but that kind of would have looked like a kind of like a slap in the face to the writers, and it was also just like. Like you said, it was so important to have them, like, there on set, because though, like, I would argue that maybe not a lot of, like, full lines were improvised during The Office, there was, like, little ad libs or little, like, extra things that the actors would add on to the scenes themselves. But most of the show was scripted, and then having the writers there, like, the writers would sometimes, like, throw out lines or change the way things were or give, like, alternate suggestions and... Like during filming, like, really on the fly, because they were there on set. Like, it was kind of unheard of, because I guess in traditional film, the writers and the actors are, like, quite separate.
Yeah, but in The Office, they're, like, very one in the same, even. And I guess, like, they couldn't have even kept filming because some of the writers were actors, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Well, that's why BJ... Or sorry, Ryan, Kelly, and Paul, or Toby, they weren't in, like, the main bullpen. They were kind of at, like, the back of the office so that they could film scenes and not have them be in it if they were busy writing or doing something else. I think those were characters that were they could kind of like not have in all the time, and it wouldn't be strange or out of place.
I never even realized that.
Yeah, so they call and in the show they even talk about like, oh, the annex, like nobody wants to be back there, but that's where all the writers sat so that they didn't have to be like in the show the whole time. So The Office survived the writer's strike and moved on to season 5, where the main showrunner, Greg Daniels, he didn't quit The Office, but he took a big step back, and he actually asked Paul Lee Racine and Toby to another director and writer, Jen Salata. He asked the two of them to become the new showrunners for the show because he stepped away to create Parks and Recreation.
Oh, I didn't know Parks and Rec was by the same, same writer.
Mm-hmm. And he was still around. Like he would go in for the final editing stages, or if they had like really, really big storyline plots and moments and stuff like that, he would still be involved, but he did take like a big step back.
Does The Office take a different direction after that, or do the other writers do a good job of like keeping it same?
I think they did a good job of keeping it on the same trajectory, and that was one of the great things about the crew that they had, is everybody was like on the same page, everybody understood the tempo and like the vibe of the show, right? Like nobody wanted to make big changes or do anything like that. Like everyone was very collaborative, all working towards like the same goal.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. But the hard part about having a show that was successful despite not having like any super, super big names is the network was very much under the idea that if they got big TV names or superstars, movie stars, that the show would perform even better. And they were always under constant pressure to add like bigger and bigger names to the show, even though that would kind of like jeopardize the integrity of the show, right?
Yeah.
But that's when they were having so much pressure from the network that they decided to bring in Kathy Bates, who played Jo Bennett. Like she was the CEO of Saber, who bought Dunder Mifflin, and stuff like that. And then season 6 is also when a lot of the actors started to like direct a few episodes themselves. So like BJ was a writer, but he also started directing a little bit. Same with John Krasinski, Steve Carell, Mindy Kaling, and Rainn Wilson. Like they all kind of got to direct episodes, which I think is pretty cool.
They just got more and more involved with the creative process, and it became more and more collaborative as the show went on. That's cool.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't know that the actor who played Jo Bennett was also a famous person, but I don't know anything about anything. So
that's fair. Yeah, Kathy Bates.
I can't believe you didn't know who Amy Adams was.
Well, they also had like Idris Elba come in for a little bit, and
wow.
Yeah. And then I think the biggest hiccup for the show ultimately was season 7 when NBC refused to renew Steve Carell's contract.
What happened?
Nobody really knows for sure. So for the longest time, Steve just like talked about like, oh, I want to step away from the show, spend more time with my family, blah, blah, blah. Like he was being so polite about it. And then it didn't really come out till recently that the cast and crew was like, no, Steve like wanted to stay on and continue the show, but NBC like refused to renew his contract.
I wonder if there was like a fight or something, or.
Well, nobody really knew why. And like, so in the beginning I talked about Kevin Reilly, like he staked his entire reputation and career on this show. He pushed for it, he advocated for it, and by this time season 7, like he did not work at NBC anymore, so there wasn't really anyone there really like championing for the show.
Guess
a lot of network execs like still didn't like or understand the show despite its like massive success. So kind of a conspiracy there, but the kind of general consensus is just NBC did Steve
It would
30.
Not be an episode of Arcana Archives without a conspiracy theory, so.
Fair. So, big sad Steve Carell, goodbye Michael, in season 7.
And that's when the show really changed trajectory.
It changed slightly, but yeah, so season 8 came about and the network was like, okay, so we don't have Steve anymore. We need somebody who's as famous or how about even more famous than him to be the star of the show now. And the cast was kind of like, you know, we have something really good going on here. We have a really solid foundation and really funny, talented people. We don't need to bring in a star to continue the success of the show.
Yeah.
But the network disagreed. Thus, James Spader was brought in as Robert California temporarily. And everyone said, like, James is a remarkable actor. He's, again, very famous. Chelsea, you would know him as the voice of Ultron in Avengers Age of Ultron.
Really?
Yeah, that's James Spader.
You'd know Amy Adams as the Amelia Earhart in Night at the Museum 2 or Lois Lane in all of the new DC movies.
You're assuming that I've seen any DC movie or Night at the Museum, which
I know
not.
You've seen Marvel. I know that you're a Marvel fan. So he does the voice of Android Ultron. And he came in, but he's not from a comedy background. So his acting style was very different, and he kind of had a difficult time keeping up with, like, all of the on-the-fly changes and improvs and stuff that the cast was used to making.
Yeah.
But everyone enjoyed working with him, to say the least, and it just wasn't, like, a perfect fit for the show. Like, in my opinion, like, season 8 is definitely my least favorite season of The Office. So, and given all of that, like, the cast and the show were so worried that NBC was just going to cancel them, that they would just kind of have, like, the rug ripped out from underneath them. So, it was kind of a group consensus that in season 9 that they would end the show. They were like, we want to tell the story how we want to tell it and end on our terms.
And I think they ended at a really good time, because if they had, like, kept going on the path that they were going, I think it would have gotten, like, old and stale. But instead they ended on, like, a beautiful note.
Exactly. So, like, they didn't want to change anything, but they also knew that they couldn't run like that forever. And I agree that they ended it very, very well and at the appropriate time. Like, it all kind of wrapped up together nicely. And yeah, season 9 was so pivotal that, like, Greg Daniels came back to the show and a lot of earlier directors came back. Like, I would argue that a man named Ken Kwapis was really, really important at the beginning of the show. He was a director and he really understood the early days of The Office. He, like, directed 13 episodes, including the pilot, the season finale of season 2, which is when Jim and Pam, like, had their first kiss, and the finale. Like, he did a lot of, like, the really, really important, like, kind of core episodes of the show that really had a lot. Yeah. Because a lot of people think that it's just, like, a comedy show, but the true heart of The Office is it's a comedy show, but also a love story. Like, everyone thinks that the main focus is Michael, but the kind of, like, the true core of the show is Jim and Pam.
I was going to say, when you were saying that Michael was, like, the main character at the beginning, I was like, oh, I thought the story was about, like, Jim and Pam.
Yeah. No, I was circling back
Jim
to
and
it. Yeah. And then that's when I elaborated on, like, they realized that love, like, having those awkward, hilarious, cringy moments was balanced out by having those really sweet, tender, meaningful moments as well. And that's what made the show so great.
Yeah, like, really, the contrast really made everything stand out.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that's why the show is still so popular to this day. It kind of still baffles everyone who's involved in it that all this time later, it's just as, if not more, beloved than it was.
Yeah, I mean, I would be baffled if I did something in 2004 and people were like, hey, you remember that thing you did in 2004?
Yeah, and it's, like, doubly times more popular than it was back then. Like, I don't know, it's kind of a phenomenon, but
yeah, it's a cult classic.
Literally. Yeah. And I mean, like, there is so much more to talk about and so many people behind the scenes more to talk about, from like producers and directors and editors and stuff like that. Like, Justin Spencer was a producer / editor of the show, and he actually went on to create the kind of, like, I don't want to call it an Office spinoff, but it's kind of like very, very similar to The Office in that regard. He created the show called Superstore.
Oh. I've been meaning to watch that. I hear it's really good.
See, I haven't watched it yet either, because I'm worried that I love The Office so much that, like, it would ruin it for me. I don't know how. Yeah. I think that, but yeah. And like, there was just, and honestly, so like, this is just like 10% of everything that went into the show, like a very, very brief synopsis. I got a lot of my information from the Office Lady podcast, which is done by Jenna Fisher, aka Pam, and Angela Kenzie, aka Angela Martin, because they're like best friends in real life. They met on the show and just like stayed super close. And so they have a podcast where they watch each episode, break down the plot, talk about what went into filming it, have a whole bunch of different people in for interviews to talk about like behind the scenes and stuff like that. And then Brian Baumgartner, who plays Kevin, he has a podcast called An Office Deep Dive. And same thing, where he interviews people about different factions and stuff about the show. So
if you like this episode of Arcana Archives, there's lots of resources to find more podcasts about The Office.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
We'll have to have you back for a part two, because it sounds like you have like a ton more facts to go.
I don't know. I could, if I'm really interested in something, I could talk about it forever.
Again, that's what makes you the perfect guest for the archives.
Well, if anything, I hope that this maybe inspires Rogan to watch it.
Yeah, you should watch The Office, Rogan.
I can't watch TV unless I'm like with somebody.
So
we should watch The Office, Rogan.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is Office watch parties.
Office watch party.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on again. I love talking about things I love.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a great joy to have on.
Oh, that's another one for the archives.
Hey! Woo!
Thank you for listening to the Arcana Archives, an exploration into nerddom.
If you have any questions or suggestions for future topics or guests, please reach out to us at arcanacollective.archives@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Facebook or Instagram with the username @ArcanaArchives.
Hope to see you again.